Texas had to cap the number of students who become eligible to receive special education services at 8.5%. But our national average is 13%. But because of all of the legislative issues that are at play, Texas schools in Texas couldn't go beyond that 8.5 cap, which meant a whole bunch of kids that need services don't qualify for services. So that's an example of why you can't be employed by that system and be able to tell the world the system's not working, and I want to be part of the solution. At the end of the day, we all, most of us, we need a paycheck.
Sure.
You know, I would be lying to you if I told you that I can't afford to do this for free. I love it, but we all,
yeah,
you know, we need a roof over our heads and those sorts of things. And so, in fact, the thing that I'm working on, the original Novus Academy, from the very beginning, I formed two nonprofits, and the parent nonprofit of this is What If We Could, and What If We Could is predicated on, what if we could change education for every single person in this country, regardless of anything, socioeconomic status, strengths, difficulties, regardless of anything, beginning with school culture? I mean, what if we could? And so Novus, because we, you know, I bought out Hill School of Grapevine, started Novus. Novus is meant to be the vehicle that does that. And so now we're at the point where I'm beginning to shift to developing the Novus Academy demonstration and lab school, where we'd be doing kind of what we're proposing, where before you came for a day and you spent a day kind of observing. What I'm proposing building is the place that you, as a professional educator, can come to for a week. And we would have the ability to come into your space too, to help you. I'm proposing pure and open partnerships with public schools, using the what we do with the students to train educators in that way. I'm not talking about sit and get typical. I'm talking about bringing you in here for a period of time.
Real professional development.
True professional development. Because nobody's doing it.
Yeah.
It's not happening. And so that's how I'm convinced that this is going to be part of we. And I include you as the collective we. We are going to be part of the solution. Because that's really all we've got. Mm-hmm. You have the reality of your constraints. And those aren't going away. They're not going away. So somebody like me, who's had the luxury of figuring out, okay, what are the workarounds? What can you do given the reality of your situation? But you have to live it. You have to be able to come in. You have to be able to try it and do it next to somebody to know what's going to work and what's not going to work. And so that's where I want to head. And I believe that when we're successful, when we get there, when we're doing that, that's how you get more. That's how it's going to start spreading. It's going to be your, and for your district, you know, you've got a great district and they send teachers here. It's going to be getting other public schools and public school districts to be willing to make the investment, you know, let your people come
mm-hmm.
to do this. That's how we're going to change this. And I don't know of another private school educator that's going to do that, because that comes from a place of purpose and passion. That's, you know, my goal. I'm 57, so I've got more behind me than in front of me. And so what I'm after is I want to impact generations of kids I'm never going to meet. And that's what this is about. And to do it at the level I want to do it, we have to do it the way I'm. You and I have to partner. We have to partner. And I hope that we get to a point that model, that piece, people start hearing that, and so we're not stuck with us and them.
Yeah.
We're stuck with a partnership. And I've been doing that for years. We've been sharing professional development with your district and some others, and it works beautifully because we aren't in competition.
Mm-hmm.
We are not. And that's most private school, public school people are feeling that now. They're feeling like it's competition, like we're going to lose kids.
Oh, it's definitely ramped up.
Yeah, you're feeling it. And I think most private schools are in competition with public schools. But not me. Not me, because again, I'm after the kids who are overlooked and underserved. And if we tell the truth, it's way more than 13%. Given everything going on in our world, who wouldn't benefit from going to a place where they welcome you every day, going to a place where they support you, a place where there's relationship, and they push you and you discover those things about yourself.
So whose job is it to make this happen? I mean, there's only one Kathy Edwards. There's only one Ron Clark.
But I think it's our job to find and groom the next ones. I think it's, you know, my life experiences, just like his, our life experiences have been such that I can sit in this seat and I can say to you, I can look you in the eye and say, oh, I'm going to do it. And I want to talk to you about this plan I have. I'm going to raise $10 million, $10 at a time. We're going to find 1 million people to do it, to do this thing. But it's having the life experience to sit in the seat to be able to say, I know how to do it. And it's having the conviction and the tenacity and the, frankly, stupidity to believe, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
You know, and all of the people, my whole career has been people telling me all the reasons why what I want to do won't work. My entire career, every time I sat in those ARD meetings, every time I was creating IEPs and I was the one saying, why are we saying 70% mastery across the board? If this child can't write a complete sentence, how are they going to write a paragraph? We need 100% mastery.
Yeah, I've sat in groups where teachers, you know, just talking about getting kids to read books.
Yeah.
And them going, well, you know, it's not going to happen.
Like, yeah.
Go home. Like, what are you, like...
Exactly. Who are you to say it's not going to happen? Because, you know, what I've learned is human beings, especially children, they're going to meet you at whatever expectation you hold.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you're supporting them along the way, as long as you're not punishing behavior out of them, as long as you're guiding them and helping them understand themselves, they're going to meet you wherever you hold that expectation.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you're right. There's one Kathy Edwards, and she's 57 years old. But I'm going to do it. Because in doing it, in just having a conversation with you today, just the fact that we were finally able to get together and I was reminded that you have a son with autism significantly increases the odds that you are going to be one of those that's going to be the proponent. You're going to be one of those that's going to be out there improving education, because for whatever reason, you have a son with autism. And it's not our place to ask why. It's, you know, God sent him to you for a reason, and our job is to figure out, okay, what is it? And I believe, I've always believed, it's our duty and obligation as human beings, as educators, as parents, it is our duty and obligation to reach to those coming behind us sharing similar difficulties and give them a hand up, for goodness sakes. The fact that you're a public school educator with a son with autism, just by definition, means your son's going to have a better educational experience than someone who's a non-educator, because you know what to look for.
Mm-hmm.
And you are going to be more willing to push yourself even more to do some of the things that I'm proposing doing.
The thing that I find most common with people like you, right, is, and what I mean by that are people that are willing to step out and do something that a lot of people would consider crazy or a lot of people would consider impossible, is in education, you don't run into a lot of those people.
No.
At least I don't. And you're shaking your head no.
too.
And that, you know, in business it happens all the time. There's always that business person that's like, you know, what if, right?
Yeah.
What if? Where did the what if go in education? Was it ever there, do you think? Or is it just not hit that? Or I don't know. In my head, it's like we're hitting the point to where I feel like people are going to start saying what if because there's nothing else.
Yeah. I think we're getting to the point where I think it's going to be not what if, I think it's going to be what can be. So let's look at our profession. And if we look at our profession in the early stages, our profession doesn't attract risk takers. So a lot of people, especially early, you know, when we kind of shifted from being an educator, being a person who's held in high esteem, we kind of shifted to our profession is more females than males in the field of education. And back when I started my career, and frankly, one of the reasons I did it was that whole Christmas off, spring break off, summer's off. So it was considered to be a nice job for a mother. And that's kind of, I think, where it originated. And then we promote most often from within. And so we're kind of, by definition, we're not risk takers, educators. We, you know, kind of like that security of knowing we're not risk takers, but at the same time, we are strong and stubborn. And so by that, I mean, your classroom is your classroom, and that's your domain. And you are in charge of everything in your domain, and heaven forbid somebody try to mess with your domain. Right. So we're those kind of people, but we're also, we move as a pack. We don't, we're not risk takers, because what's the benefit? What happens if you're an outlier in education, if you're a risk taker? Where's the reward?
Yeah.
Where's the, you know, and so it's the people who rise are those teachers. And, you know, Ron Clark is an excellent example. The teacher in the classroom doing all kinds of things with kids and everybody around him thinking it's wrong, he's nuts, it's, and then all of a sudden one day everybody wakes up and realizes he's got kids doing nobody thought he could do. But by our training and our profession, we're not trained to be risk takers and to even know what's possible. And, you know, like I had to step outside. I had to step out of that, and I even had to step out of the classroom to realize, why is what we believe to be so? Think about it. How many professions are there where you really don't negotiate salary? Teachers don't negotiate salary.
Yeah.
School districts have their thing, and this is what we pay, and after so many years, this is what you pay, this is what you pay. Well, what profession do people not have the ability to negotiate salary? You have the ability to negotiate salary in education when you move into upper level administration, but even then, it's these bands.
Yeah.
It's these, you know, these things, so it's not. And the other thing that I think happens is we lose a lot of good people with potential, because, you know, I've always said I love to get a hold of a teacher with fire in their belly. When they still believe they can set the world on fire, and they're brand new and they're ready to go, and it's before the ones who are, you know, kind of jaded and will tell you all the reasons why what you want to do won't work. And we beat them up. We don't support them. You know, think about the number in your career so far, the number of first, second, and third year teachers that they're gone. They don't stay.
Happens all the time.
All the time.
All the time. Well, it's funny. Our school specifically had massive turnaround for a long time. We were a school that was struggling in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Culture was terrible, and all that. And I came in right at the end of that. We flipped it around, and now, I mean, it's light and day just from the few years that I've been there. But, I mean, I've seen the people I started with are not the people I'm with now.
No.
Not in the, unless they were they've been there for a while, but you know, so many teachers now, they sell insurance or they go off. They went somewhere and did something else.
They go off somewhere and make some money.
Yeah,
and you know what happens to people? So I'm old enough to now have learned this. So yeah, that's what happens, because you know, you go off to earn a living, and then when people hit their 50s, people who've been making money their whole lives, there's this fundamental shift to, I want a purpose. I need to do something that's purpose, and you're not going to find a more purpose-driven profession than our profession. And so, but I'm go back to, I want to talk about your school for a second, because your school is an example of a group of people who came together, a leader that did step out, a leader that did have a different mindset, and then a group of people, like-minded people who are coming together, and what you guys really are doing is you're stepping out. You're not, you know, some of the best things that I can think happen, and you can do it as an administrator until you can't, are the things like the administrator who comes in with clear vision, clear purpose, you know, does things the right way, but it's the person who comes in and it's not, no, I'm not going to, we are not going to have the school be the standard beige color, whatever. We're not, I'm not going to fill out the requisition. I'm not going to do all that. We're just going to paint the walls and ask for forgiveness later.
Yeah.
It's that, that administrator, that instructional leader who's willing to go to bat for the whole school and say, I know, you know, I know the district wants these numbers. I know we've got to hit these numbers. I need you to believe that I can hit those numbers in a different way with the staff that I have. And it's hard to get yourself into a position. In public school, when you do a good job, you get moved somewhere else. When you do a bad job, you get moved somewhere else. They don't get rid of you when you do a bad job. So it takes, you know, it really takes... By 3 years, I think you're hitting your stride as a teacher and as an administrator. By 5 years, I think you've pretty much, you got it figured out. It's hard to find school administrators that get to stay in a building long enough to create a culture.
And that's hilarious that you use that timeline just now, because my academic coach, who's also a really good friend of mine, he probably one of the smartest people I know, hands down, but he was talking like that. He was saying... A lot of teachers, specifically young teachers, who, you know, look at millennial statistics, see how often we change careers. But we have, you know, by the time they're getting good, they're leaving.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what you just said.
It's exactly what happens. I moved my career, my whole career, until I got into private schools. I moved every 2 to 3 years until I got to the one where I created the program for the Blue Ribbon one. I moved. It just... That's kind of what we do, and I'm not a millennial, and millennials, it's interesting that you bring that up, because it's that, that really cool combination of constant movement, but it's driven by, I want to make an impact. I want my life to make an impact, which, you know, when you realize that and you think about that, you would think that millennials would be flocking to a profession like education, because talk about impact. Talk about making a difference, but the other things that you need, those other pieces aren't there. The ability to be creative, the ability to constantly create.
Yeah, I think they feel stifled.
Completely.
Because I get like that sometimes. Luckily, I have an administrator who I pitch him a crazy idea, which I just did this week, and he goes, whatever you need from me, just let me know.
See?
And that's, and once, when I'm the type of person... That when I get a freedom to do something, I explode, because once I don't feel stifled, life is grand for me. But the moment I feel like there's all these roadblocks, it's like my interest goes somewhere else, because it's like, I'm like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, because otherwise you're just going through the motions, and that's what I see here in the teachers here is, as I call it, you know, wind you up and turn you loose. You're a professional educator, for goodness sakes. You know that, you know, we've got these students, we've got to teach them. Do what you think is right. The other piece, though, is they know they're supported 100%. And that's the other touchy thing in a lot of schools is you may want to try something, but if you don't have an administrator who really believes the only way you get better at anything is to make mistakes and learn from them, that stifles everything, too.
Yeah.
If you don't have freedom and flexibility to fail. And the thing is, who gets better without failing?
And public school's terrified of failing.
Exactly.
Literally. That's why we have ratings for everything.
In fact, one of we haven't put it out there yet, but one of the artists who's working with us, he's written a blog, and he said he was going to write this blog because he was here one day. And part of the reason he's here is because I just do what I do, and there's nothing written. I don't know why. I just do it. And so he's observing and capturing it. And this thing he said, do you realize that you teach failure? You expect failure and you teach it. And I said, you know, not so much. Help me understand. And so as it turns out, I do. And so here's the example. Because you're right. Everybody's afraid of failure. And nobody gets better unless they're forced to change. And nobody... really improves until you get to the point that you're willing to risk your heart and your head and know that it's not fatal. And so what I've done for years and years I didn't realize I was doing is I set situations up. I set things up for kids to fail. so that they can feel what that is and understand it's not failure. You got to go, you got to come at it a different way. We've got to figure out kind of what you do. But if we don't talk about it openly, if we don't, you know, here, they're all taught that the first time that you do something that you weren't supposed to do or whatever, it ends up with a bad outcome. We can call it a mistake. I don't have a problem calling it a mistake, but you learn from mistakes. The second time you repeat the same behavior in the same way, that's a choice. That's a completely different scenario. And so then he was just going through these examples of how I do that, not even realizing I do that. And what we end up with is extremely resilient students that aren't afraid to try something because they come to believe the culture is teaching, and they come to believe nobody gets better without failing. Nobody gets better without taking a risk, and you have to risk your heart and your head.
And that's my I was a thousand points just popped into my head just because in the world we live in now, if you haven't caught on, I'm a global thinker. Everything I think about is, you know, taking it to the massive scale. But, you know, the world that we live in is filled with, whether you're an adult or a kid, we're filled with gratitude that we don't really have to try for. And what I mean by that is if we want food, we can get food.
Yes.
For most of us.
Yes.
You know, there's situations where we can get our entertainment, we can get our food, we can get whatever we want.
Yeah.
Kids and everything, we don't have to try, we don't have to fail to do things. So we enter a profession that's incredibly difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond, I couldn't even describe how difficult, there's no way I could have been prepared for my first year.
Yeah.
Like,
no,
fully.
No.
Right? And I got kicked in. That's a fun story for later. But you know, and it's just so hard. And a lot of people, I feel like they quit because they're not given the environment, meaning the administrators aren't creating this culture of, yeah, you failed. So what are you going to do next?
Yeah.
You know, like encouraging.
What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it?
And that seems like a really hard culture to breed. I guess you have to have the right people.
You have to have the right people. And so what I notice when we bring new staff in, because we, you know, we tell them these things, I tell them that the only way, you know, around here, when we say the only sign of weakness is not asking for help, is true, because in a typical school, especially a high school, you don't ask for help. That's a sign of weakness. You don't, and if you've got something figured out, you don't share it. You close your door and you kind of keep it. And so creating a culture that was completely different was important to me, because what my core belief is, we're good. We're good. We're pretty good. But collectively, we're amazing. Each one of us is good. But when we come together on behalf of a child or on behalf of a family, we're pretty formidable.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what it takes in life. You know, we're in this kind of this place in life with technology and those things where we're also we're raising a generation that has no clue what relationship is. And we know that one of the most powerful things you'll ever have with a student is relationship. You know, those kinds of things are coming into play too. And so it's, you know, as strongly as I believe about, you know, because I have strong political beliefs myself, and you know, a lot of it is just like a really bad reality show right now. Every day you get up, it's like, oh my gosh, what did he tweet today? What,
yeah,
you know, what is today bringing? It's kind of entertaining, but that said, we are positioned right now. This couldn't be a better, like, you know, I tell you, I'm going to raise $10 million, $10 at a time. Nobody's ever done it. Hide and watch. Because if you have the opportunity to give up two Starbucks or a movie to directly impact education for all children in our country, why wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't you? Because it's what it's going to take to create those things, but it's not going to happen. None of this is going to go well if we continue an us and them mentality. And so I'll tell you what we did here. For the first round of her confirmation hearings, they had the wear red for Ed day. Oh, there were maybe a couple people that didn't wear red. Oh yeah, we're in red. Wear red for Ed, because I have to be sure that everyone who's a part of our culture understands we're a private school, but we're public school educators at our core. And it's a unique position, a unique situation to be in. I still have, Okay, here's what I would say. I still have on my car garland from Christmas. It's up there because it's red. So what message am I spreading?
Right.
And now awesome. I say it's there. First I said it was there through Valentine's Day. Well, that's come and gone. And now I have a nondescript car, and I can always find my car in the parking lot. But one of the teachers, I said, I guess I have to take it off. And said, no, wear red for Ed.
That's hilarious. Vouchers.
Yes.
Are vouchers the boogeyman of education? Meaning, are they really just something that we talk about that really aren't dangerous? Or do they serve a danger to education as we know it?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. Are they dangerous? Are they the boogeyman?
Because it's being thrown around all the time.
Yes and no. Yes and no. So the are they dangerous? They're dangerous if the messaging is, this is going to help you, child living in poverty. This is going to help you, if you're a student in a low-performing school, this is going to help you. Mm-hmm. The danger is in the messaging. The having a voucher, having this coupon, this thing that, you know, that a lot of them aren't even a thing. It's just they wire the money into your account. But having the flexibility as a parent to choose the school that my child is going to, I don't think that's dangerous. I think it's an instrument. I think it's a vehicle that's going to wake schools up. I think it's going to be the thing that's going to have everybody, instead of being complacent, instead of saying, you know, it's broken, it's bad, it's this, it's that, we can't do anything, our kids are poor, our kids are this, our kids are that. I think it's going to wake us all up, because the reality is, schools are strapped for money. Mm-hmm. The economy, the whole idea of, I mentioned inclusion before, inclusion is now a budgetary consideration. It's done because districts in Texas, with Robin Hood, lost money, and so it's not as expensive to put a teacher in several classrooms as it is to have several teachers doing it. So it's a budgetary consideration. So there's going to have to be action. That's the good part. The danger is knee-jerk reactions. The danger is, you alluded to it before, the danger is those people who are just looking at dollar signs. And so schools are going to pop up and they're not going to be doing the right things. And the danger is the schools, the administrators, the school districts are going to panic and increase. You guys are already, you're pushed beyond a reasonable level of stress to try to get things done. And if you're hit with, and now you're going to do this because we can't afford to lose more students, and, you know, heaven forbid we ever get to the point that your job relies on the number of students you're able to keep or not keep. And so I think to answer the question, is a voucher dangerous or beneficial? I think it depends on whose hand it goes into. And I believe it depends on the decisions that are made regarding how are those vouchers issued. What are we monitoring? Who's going to keep track of whether, you know, I receive vouchers for 10 kids and I even have all 10 kids in my school. And so I'm going to choose to believe that it's going to be a blessing in the end. I think it's going to be a nightmare in the beginning, because we're all running scared. Mm-hmm. You know, I can joke about the political climate, but we, you know, we really don't know when we wake up in the morning. Now what? And I worry about people staying in the profession. You're already overstretched. And if now the new messaging is your job depends on whether or not we keep students in our school or we don't, we lose them to vouchers. If you have the choice between selling widgets and being able to go home and have a nice time with your family, or adding more to what you already do for other people's children, what are you going to do? What's your choice going to be? So if it was somebody besides her, given her history, given what we know so far, it's the faith-based piece that scares the bejesus out of me, frankly. Because who defines faith-based? Who defines what a faith-based school is? And so it's easy to find information regarding what she and her husband believe thereafter. But who's... You talk about excluding. I think a faith-based school is more exclusive than it is inclusive.
Sure.
And that's what has me worried the most is, are we strong enough? Are their voices strong enough to stand up and say, oh yeah, no, No, we're not going to pump all of this money into faith-based education. We're going to... You know, and then it comes down to, okay, so where's Trump going to find the $20 billion that it's going to take to get this stuff started? And where are the states going to find the money that it's going to take to add to that?
Mm-hmm.
How's that going to happen? And it's not as easy as is it, you know, I think people are just saying, we're gonna, you know, there was a thing, Betsy, it was, she said, I want to say it was like 2007 or 2006 or something. Her statement was, there aren't enough philanthropists with enough money to change schools the way they need to be changed. And it's along the lines of the faith-based school choice kind of things. We have to go to the states to have it done. And so, how's that going to work? First of all, I want to know where he's going to find the money he needs to begin with to get this whole process started. But, you know, and then on the flip side, if I answer you as a private school educator, it's a blessing. Butts in seats.
Right.
And so I'm not a private school educator, though. I'm disguised as one.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're not going to hear much of anything from the private school. What you're going to be hearing from the private schools, if private schools unite, what you're going to be hearing is, we don't want any constraints. We don't want to deal with your accountability. And that's, other than that, why would a private school not be open to vouchers? Mm-hmm. As long as they either cover your tuition or families are allowed to pay the difference. It's a kind of a new, easy sort of revenue stream.
Yeah.
If you're a private school educator.
If you could say anything to whoever's listening to this, mm-hmm. let's say, you know, obviously there's teachers that listen to mm-hmm. it, but there's a lot of administrators.
Mm-hmm.
If you could tell them, like, you're, because a lot of people's reaction to Betsy mm-hmm. and this whole thing, it's been a fear-based thing on both sides, we said sure. earlier in the podcast,
sure.
but if you could tell them any reaction, what should we as educators be doing in response to so much heat on the educational community,
mm-hmm.
right? Because usually we're not even talked about, right? Like, usually no one's
Nobody's
paying attention.
Even aware of us.
But now we're right there.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, for a lot of people, it feels like this is a ride or die time.
Yeah.
This is the put up or shut up, right? I mean, whatever phrase yeah. you want to use.
Yeah.
What would you tell people if you could just talk to them right now? What should be our response to everything that's happening?
I love that question. So here's what our response needs to be. Our response needs to be exactly what we expect of our students. We expect our students to form their own opinions based on what they see with their own eyes, what they hear with their own ears, and research. And so before any one of us makes a knee-jerk reaction, I think our duty and obligation as educators is to find out as much as we can find out about who is she? You know, who is this Betsy DeVos? What's kind of going on there? I think we need to educate ourselves to find out truly, because not a whole lot of us, and not just educators, not a whole lot of the people that live in this country really know truly, okay, so how exactly does this political thing work? Like, how much power, like, her position is the least powerful position in the administration.
Mm-hmm.
So how much power does she really have? Like, can she really go in? And can she wipe out the Office of Civil Rights? Can she go in and, you know, because there's a large number of people, especially the LGBTQPLR, whatever all the acronyms are now, they're scared. And they're scared because their rights, as far as education goes, their educational rights are protected through the Office of Civil Rights, which is part of the Education Department. But when we're scared, when human beings are scared, we don't react in the right ways. When we educate ourselves, just like we tell our kids, learn as much as you can about this whole situation, and then you take a stand, and then you make an opinion. Because right now, where are most people really getting their information? They're getting it from Facebook, they're getting it from whichever news source or whatever. I think that this is a point where we as professional educators act like professional educators, and we find out as much as we can find out about her, so that when somebody says, this is true, we know whether it's an alternative fact or not an alternative fact. Because if you think about it, the people with power are the people who have knowledge and they know how to execute. They know how to manage and massage a situation. So, like, for me, I would love, like, you know, the people, like, who do you want to have dinner with or whatever? Mm-hmm. Man, I'd like to be in a room with her. I would love to have a conversation with her to just, you know, because if she's savvy, if she's smart, she's going to be having conversations with educators, I hope. I hope she's going to do what a savvy person would do, but we can't assume she will, so we have to educate ourselves, and that's where our power is. And so that's what I'm doing. That's what I've been doing since I first heard her name, learning as much as I can learn so that when I'm in front of whomever I'm in front of, whether it's a group of private school people, it's the families, it's the public school, I want to be able to speak based on knowledge I've gathered, instead of, because if it's a knee-jerk reaction, if I go with my knee-jerk reaction, I'm not going to support anything she does or says. Mm-hmm. Because she's not an educator and she doesn't have. And that's where most educators are.
And she tripped up in the interview and completely, said things that educators completely jumped on instantly.
Yeah, but if you think about it, okay, let's take it a step backwards. All those things are true, but here's another part of this. Yes, she's a billionaire several times over. Mm-hmm. But you don't get the things through that she and her husband got through with regard to education, with regard to the things that they believe in, if you don't know what you're doing. The big question is, I think the question of the day is, why'd she take that job? What would make a person who, you know, we had an example, a teacher came to my office today and she said, you know, she said, I've been thinking about this. If I walk up to your door and I say, can I come inside? And you say no, but the teacher with Kyla was in there. And Kyla says yes, so I have a no and a yes. And it takes Joe to be the tiebreaker to get the yes so that I can come in. I'm not going to want to come in. I'm not going to come in. So why did Betsy walk through the door?
Especially when you have no really big reason to do so.
No. And that's why I'm scared, because I think it's being fueled by a type of Christianity and a belief that they're going to be able to push things upon people under the guise of education. Other than that, I can't imagine why she walked through that door. Why would a billionaire several times over walk into a space that nobody wants you? Unless you've got a strong, strong agenda. And we know it's not public school. She's never been there. Her kids were never there. Mm-hmm. So I'm always looking for what's motivating the person I'm talking to. And it's like, you know, there's an agenda, and that's what we need to be afraid of. And that's why we need to be educated and know, okay, Betsy, if we're going vouchers, if we're going school choice, if we're going public versus private versus charter, I'm going to be watching you like nobody's business to make sure you're not fueling funds into faith-based schools that are aligned with your core beliefs, and you're leaving public schools out to dry, and you're helping fund for-profit charters that are coming along. That's going to be my role. That's why I'm... And that's what I think we need to do as educators, is we need to unite, but not with... you know, you're always more powerful in a conflict, in a situation riddled with conflict, when you're the calm one. When you're the voice of reason, and you're the voice that's just saying, I hear what you're saying, but this is what we're going to do. I hear what you're saying, Betsy, but we are not going to fill our country with faith-based schools that are aligned with your core beliefs, because that's not what the United States is. And so that's the only thing I'm really worried about is, why did she walk through the door?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd love to have a conversation with her. And maybe someday I will. Who knows?
I mean, it's not outside the realm of possibility, I imagine. Send that invitation up. Say, hey, I know the media's all over you, and you're being blocked by protesters from going into schools.
I'm telling you, Bessie, you want to have a conversation with me. You do.
Maybe you would hit that right thing for her. Because she's got to be savvy somehow.
Oh, she's savvy.
It's in there. It's just a matter of...
She's savvy. And don't get me wrong, I'm a person of faith. But that's meant to be... That's a private thing. It's not our place as educators, especially as educators. It is not our place to tell children how to think and what to believe. Our job is to provide them with all of the options and teach them how to discern, teach them how to, I guess think would be the right thing, teach them how to make a decision, a rational decision based on all of the variables versus making a decision based on the loudest voice or what your parents told you you're supposed to believe. I always tell the kids, watch with your eyes, you listen with your ears, and we always believe what we see people do before we ever believe what we see them say. And that's what I'm doing. I'm watching Trump, which is, I don't even want to go there. And now I'm watching her. And if you think about it, it's pretty quiet right now.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty quiet right now. Why is that?
I don't know. I mean, we'll see.
I don't either.
I mean, she's so fascinating because it just, I mean, who would have thought the person ahead of education in our government would be the reason the vice president for the first time ever has to jump down and break a tie?
Exactly.
No one could have predicted that.
No one could have.
Just like no one could have predicted that Trump would have gotten elected.
Any of it. And, you know, if you think about this, so I also have this weird belief about money. And my belief about money is, how much does a person really need, truly? So just imagine if with all of the billions that they have, just she and her husband, all of the billions that they have, what if part of his journey, part of what's going on here, what if she does come across some people that can help her understand how she can use some of her own personal money instead of taking money from other places to do what she says she wants to do? You want choice, you want improved education? How much money does a person really need to do that? So I'm frankly excited. I'm energized, and I think I'm energized because I kind of thrive on conflict anyway. I'm never content. I'm always looking for ways to improve things. And this is coming at a time where I've known we have the need to improve public education, but I believe it's coming at a time where public education isn't going to have a choice. They're going to be scrambling for what to do. So for a person like me...
It forces innovation.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not all bad. Mm-hmm. It's bad if we polarize and if we start casting stones and if we don't figure out what's really going on here. I think that's how you wake up one day and you realize, holy cow. It's kind of like we woke up one day and it was, how'd Trump get elected?
Yeah.
We were so busy... us and theming it, I think, and overlooking all of the markers that were there, all of the warning signs that were there. We're just so desperate in our country for something different right now. And now, I believe, based on what's been happening, I think the first few people that come along with something positive, something that somebody can grab onto that's hopeful and positive, that's what we're going to run with. You know, I even at this point, even like the stuff, some of the different things I'm seeing, the people who are just living and breathing, us versus them, you know, politically, I think they're even getting tired of it. I think our country is ready for, what are we going to do positive? And could just imagine if we were the ones. I did the Women's March in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
I did that. And it was excellent. It was fascinating. I didn't have any particular agenda other than I believe that you have to model what you teach. And part of what we're teaching around here is, I tell the kids, it's finding your voice. And finding your voice means when you really want something and you want it bad, but someone tells you no. Like, you really want to play a video game and your parents say no. And you know no is the right answer. You accept it with grace and respect. But when you want something and somebody tells you no, how are you going to turn that into a yes? Mm-hmm. You don't beg. You don't plead. You don't bully. You don't fight into it. You negotiate into it. You educate yourself and you negotiate. And so that the reason for the Women's March was to be able to tell the students, yeah, I did. I don't have a particular agenda at the moment. You know, Betsy wasn't around it yet.
Right.
But it's the fact that we live in a country that allows us to do that, and just wanting to be part of sending a message in whatever way I, as an individual, could send a message to let the powers that be know, I'll support you. But you start doing good and great things, I'll be right there supporting you because I believe what I see. But if you're not, what have I got to lose?
Mm-hmm.
57. What are we going to do?
Sure.
You know, it's...
You know, one of a person that we had on the podcast, name was Alan Small, by the way.
Uh-huh.
You should check out that episode because he does great things with science clubs and whatnot.
Does he? Oh, yeah, I need to listen awesome. To him.
And he has his own little private thing that he does. He works with Castleberry ISD right now.
Yeah.
He does great things. He's a huge listener of the podcast.
I need to listen to it.
Yeah, he's awesome. But he posted on Facebook the other day, he goes, the way to solve what's happening right now isn't to get louder as right. educators, it's to make great schools. And I was like,
I love it.
And if I butchered that quote, I'm sorry, Alan, but it was that. That's true. The general message. And I was like, that's
it's true.
Yeah.
Well, if you go back, so think about this. If we go back to what I said, you know, much earlier, with where she and her husband are saying that the places we gathered used to be churches and now they're schools, it goes right to what he's saying. So if we're building great schools, places that people want to be,
mm-hmm.
and they're supported, that's pretty formidable. You're not going to be able to. If we're educated and we're supporting one another, yeah, we're, you know, what is the Trump thing? Bring America back or make America great or whatever it is. You know, and then that's where I think so much of what I hope for our profession can happen, the whole idea of treating our profession like a profession, respect us. Just imagine if, well, we've seen the, just so far, like the women's marches, and it's been men and women together. Those are violent things. Those are, for now, it's just people, just, I'm here. I don't like what I'm seeing. I'm not happy with this. And so imagine if as educators we do the same thing. We know what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
From the outside looking in, you may think I'm an F school, and I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to hear me. But if we stick with the whole idea of they're going to believe what they see before they believe what we say. And so if we can show them that, throw whatever you want to throw at us. Throw it. Because we're going to live what we say. We're not going to... And it is. If you think in a conversation, in an argument, in anything, it's the person who remains calm. It's the person who, with their deeds before their words, does it. That's who comes out in the end. Because the rest is noise. You know, worst case scenario, Donald Trump is going to make a lot of noise for 4 years. And we just have to hope that in the process he doesn't, you know, do something really horrible. But that's just noise. We need to do the work. And what better place to do it? I mean, schools are pretty cool places.
Yeah.
And, you know, kids are full of possibilities. And I don't think I'm any different from any other educator when I say, my goal before I'm gone is to impact generations that I'll never meet. And that's what we do as teachers, if you think about it. Some comment that you've said to one of your students is going to be repeated when one of those students is a mother or father to one of their children. It may be repeated when they're a grandparent. What you're saying and doing today, parts of it, are going to show up in generations you'll never meet. What other profession has that luxury?
Mm-hmm.
They don't. So we just need more good educators. We need people that'll stay.
And hopefully this is going to be the episode that gets them to stay. Hopefully, you know, they listen to this and they take all the positive. And hopefully we...
I hope that's what they're hearing. What I hope people are understanding and hearing is this is not a horrible thing. Yeah. What I hope they're hearing is hope. And the fact that... we have all the skills we need. We have all the tools we need. We just have to do what we expect of our students, educate ourselves, perform as professionals, and as a teacher, if we lose our cool, they fire us. And so, you know, why would we lose our cool?
Mm-hmm.
Your strength is in the numbers and in the just a strong, united voice. And I don't know how much help. I really don't know what I'll be able to do as far as the rift, the us versus them, because that's always been there. It's kind of like in school. So there are this hierarchy in schools. And so the highest, like as far as teachers go, so high school teachers are the elite.
Sure.
And then middle school teachers is like, yeah, you know, who would even want to teach middle school? Mm-hmm. And elementary teachers, the belief is, oh, that's just so easy. Unless you're one of those things. And so we got this, you know, this weird hierarchy thing going on in our profession. And so out of that comes the belief that private school educators are the elite. We get the kids that you weren't good enough for. That's the mentality. Where's that come from?
Mm-hmm.
Where's, you know, who's perpetuating that one? But that's kind of an unspoken truth. And I really, you know, it's not going to ever happen. This is, I always tell kids, don't ever say, there are no absolutes, but there are absolutes. There are absolutes. And one absolute is, I'm not going to ever be back in a, like, I won't be returning to a public school as an educator. That's not going to be part of what I do. Even though that was my intent, that was where I thought my life journey was going to take me. But I sure hope that I get to the point that I get to go back into public schools to see kind of what's going on and, you know, what are you doing? Because public school is full of life. It's full of and chaos and all of the things that, and, you know, and right or wrongness. I love that. I love that. I've always, you know, my wheelhouse as far as students go has always been the ones nobody else is willing to work with. The unlovables, the ones that everybody says are, they can't learn, they won't learn, they're bad, all of those things. That's my wheelhouse. That's because if you think about it, if you take, I know we both got to go.
No, you're good.
But when you take kids, like think of your middle schoolers, think of the middle school students you have, the ones that are those kids that nobody can reach, that just god-awful behavioral issues and that kind of stuff. So if you look at, okay, what are the positive qualities? You know, so if take the kid who is, doesn't matter what you ask him to do, he's not going to do it. And you know, as a teacher, I'm not going to poke him with a stick. Because if I do, it's not going to, you know, he's going to blow up or he's going to, so you just kind of leave him be. So just imagine if you can take that kind of a person with that level of stubbornness and that level of nobody's going to make me do anything, but get to the core of why that behavior is there and teach them to use that that thing that makes them who they are for good instead of bad. That's what I used to do when I worked with the kids. Once you get rid of all that junk and you get down to why they behave the way they behave, and that's, you know, that's part of what I love about a public school. And the other part that I love but I hate at the same time because it's a disaster is the fact that you educate everyone who walks through your door regardless of the day of the week or the time of the year. And nobody gets better doing that. How do you bring a kid in? You've got a writing program up and running and it's going, it's doing well, and then, you know, 9 weeks in, here comes the new kid with no foundational skills.
Mm-hmm.
What are you supposed to do?
I mean, you're at certain schools that are in areas that are more, you know, there's definitely way more poverty. Uh-huh. Those are the people who move more.
Constantly.
And then you lose your vertical alignment, and it's just
a mess. Yeah. That's what I learned when I was in Fort Worth, that there was a teacher there. Sylvia Dawson, and she taught, she kept me alive, and she taught me so much. But the thing was, if it was a Tuesday and it wasn't raining, they would receive at least 10 kids, 10 new kids every Tuesday if it wasn't raining.
That's crazy.
A lot of the parents wouldn't get up on a Monday.
Mm-hmm.
But they get them there on a Tuesday. And that school also fed 5 homeless shelters. And so it was just a revolving door. And that's just one school out of how many do we have? And so that, I guess that's an example of a school that, yeah, having a choice. I would want parents to have that. But the choice would have to be something that they could actually get to.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know how I don't know how you turn around that kind of a situation. Well, I do. I lied. I do. But it's not going to happen. Yeah, I lied. I love talking to you.
I love talking to you. I tell you, we can do this forever.
Yeah.
I think we're kindred spirits in a lot of ways.
See, I think so too. I think so too. Well, I could tell when you came because you got it. You got it right away before we even really showed you a whole lot or, you know, sat down to talk. Because it's what I love to observe teachers when they come. And so I can figure out pretty quickly who gets it, who can feel it, and who knows, understands what they're seeing versus the teacher that's here because it's probably part of their growth plan.
You're right.
And it's like you've been told you're going to go there and they're like, oh, yeah, no. I don't like those kids anyway. But even they soften when they see. And I think a lot of what it... Now, I'm not going to say a lot of... What do you think it is? What do you think a teacher sees when they come here and feels?
I don't know. I mean, when I think... If I try to boil it down to anything that I saw, it was... innovation might be the right word. But it really wasn't that. It wasn't that you guys were doing things that just evolved everything I was thinking about. It was the level of execution that you have at every aspect of this school. And what I mean by that is your kids, the students that you had here, were all representative of the high standards that you're holding for them, but it's keeping them to those standards.
It's holding it, yeah.
And it wasn't like it was a perfect environment because I remember we were sitting in the library when we were all climbing along to the gym or whatever. You know, one of the students, you know, they were a little hyper that day, you know, yep. They were outspoken, but it was correction in the moment.
Yep.
It was, you're not, you know, we're not going to do this, we're not going to do that, but it was explicit standards for your students. And that's something that you don't see.
Yeah.
In certain places. And that's top down because you do it for your teachers and they do it for the students. And that's what I saw when I came here was that no, you weren't compromising on the most fundamentals of education, which is holding people to high standards.
Yeah.
That's what I saw.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that because, yeah, I'm always interested to see, okay, what do you, I know what we're trying to pull off, but I don't know what you see. So I'm going to tell you real quick what we did. Because it kind of explains how things happen here. So you saw the morning, what we do in the mornings, the morning assembly stuff. So I added something to it. So now we have 20 minutes of exercise before we start the rest of the celebration. So it starts at about 5 of 8 and it goes till about 8, about 8:15. They hated it. The kids hated it. They were, it was horrible. Horrible. The teachers weren't even all that fond of it. And so, you know, we started it with, you know, walking in that multipurpose room. And then I've got the two PE teachers that lead us in different things. And major protests. Like, I mean, literally, like, I'm walking beside kids. I'm going to walk faster. Let's do this. Come on, get your arms going. Come on. Oh, you don't want silent lunch, do you? Come on. You know, they hated it. And there's one child in particular. He has autism. And you can't disrupt his schedule. I love him. You don't disrupt his schedule.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was very difficult for him for the first, probably the first 2 weeks. It was like almost impossible for him to hold it together the first week. And yesterday, I noticed for the first time, he loves it. So we're at the point now where we've been doing it since we got back from the Christmas holidays. And we're at the point now where they're doing it. They're And we see the difference in the students. Just adding that 20 minutes of physical activity before we do all the other stuff that we do, it's a difference. And so that's an example of, I knew they were going to hate it. Teachers I knew probably most of them weren't going to want to do it.
Sure.
But that's where you take a stance and we're going to do it.
What was your reasoning for putting it in?
It happened because we, like before our students take, I've read a few studies about, you know, if you have them exercise, get the heart rate up before a test, you might see an increase in the scores or whatever. And so we have two excellent, they're both adaptive PE teachers that we have on staff this year. And so they've had a push for us all year for becoming more physical, and a lot of us have Fitbits and we've been challenging the kids and stuff. So that was happening. But I came in one morning and Coach Adams, he was wanting to have a before school fitness kind of club thing before school. And some days he gets one student, some days he might get two students. You know, that's, it hadn't really caught on. But I came in one morning and I saw the little boy that was in there doing it with him, and I thought, okay, we can't get kids to come in this early, but we have them. They're here. They start coming at 7:40. And we know physical activity is good for you. And so I walked through the back door. I saw that boy in there and I thought, oh, I'll get you kids. And I didn't ask anybody. I didn't explain to the teachers what we were going to do. We just started doing it. And then one of the teachers, what she's done is the two coaches now, the two teachers alternate kind of leading it in the morning. And so from the time they arrive, they can start going into the room at 7:40. So from the time they arrive, they're walking. And then at 8, they start the organized different activities, burpees. And I mean, it's
burpees, you're in it.
Yeah, we're doing it. And so, and the teachers too. That's the other part of it, is you don't stand around and watch. We all, you know, do this. And so it was just getting all that started, and then we realized they're calmer in the, like, in their first period classes. They're calmer. And the kids who were dragging in here, and even with what we do to kind of wake the brain up and do those things, they still were looking tired. By the time they finished that, they're awake, they're alert. And another reason, an offshoot that I didn't think would come of it, is the fact that, so in a lot of our schools, they've pulled PE and they've pulled recess and stuff. But in every school, you're bringing kids in at a certain time. So why can't you set the gym up to do this? If it's the, like, they'll walk this way or this way. Why can't you set that expectation? Because you're not going to find research anywhere that says that's a negative for kids. And they can't opt out. We had two boys, but one in particular, what he started doing is he'd have his mom, you know, like, they'd get here, but they'd park in the parking lot, and he wouldn't come in until 8, because he knew if he walked in before 8, he had to do the walking. Another student with autism, and I just told him, I said, okay, here's how this works. You can choose to sit out there and not come in and walk for 15 minutes, or, you know, sit out there, not walk the 15 minutes, knowing that at lunchtime you're going to walk for 15 minutes, or you can just go ahead and come on in and get it over with. And so, next day he came in, and, but it was just a crazy idea, and it turns out it's a good idea, so it's something we're going to keep doing.
And you had the freedom to execute it.
I had the freedom to do it. And so think about it. So in a school, and I don't care how big your school is, teachers have duties. You have some place that you house kids until they're allowed to go to their classrooms. And so what if, instead of in our schools, we get those kids walking through the door and we're, it's all the yelling and all the stuff that goes on, don't sit down and be quiet, sit down and be quiet. What if you just used your staff, your gym space, or whatever your spaces are, and what if it's not a choice? What if you've, because they, of course, what we always do is we explain the rationale behind it. I don't ever ask them to do something unless I explain why this thing is going to be good for you. And then even when, you know, then when it comes down to, yeah, but I don't want to, my words are, well, please help me understand how this became a choice. I didn't know that this was a choice. And because the thing is, those kids who don't do that stuff, they don't want to do it. If you have a relationship with them, it's not that they don't want to do it. It's other things going on. And so how hard is it to, instead of, you know, having that kid who, you know, has problems and you can't get to them, so walk with them in the morning. Get your, because we all wear Fitbits. Get your steps up.
Right.
Another fundamental shift. Doesn't cost the school any money. You've already got the space. You've already got the staff. Why not do it? You don't need somebody like me coming up with that. It's, why not do it?
Yeah. Kathy, it's been amazing.
It's been wonderful. I didn't know what this would be like. Well, I was kind of scared.
The hot seat, it's not that bad. It's not
bad. And I love this microphone. I like
it. It looks so retro.
Exactly.
That's what it looks like, yeah. Anyway, to close this out for my little podcast listeners, you guys know what to do. You go to Facebook, like Teach Me Teacher. It's where you get all of our updates. Subscribe to us on iTunes if you have not. We're getting listens all across the world, so thank you guys, wherever you are, for listening. I do appreciate it, and I do see the numbers, so I see you listening over there, you two people in Japan, whoever you are.
We'll come there, too.
We're coming, Kathy and I.
Hey, we're coming. If you have a school, we'll come.
It's true.
I mean it.
We need to get it started.
They'll have to pay for the flight or something.
Oh, you know
what?
We
don't have any money yet.
But before I let you go, if someone wanted to contact you to visit Novus or whatever, what's the best way they can get contact?
Okay, so the best way would be to go to our website or to email me. And so the website is, what is the website? I haven't gone there in a long time. The Novus Academy, THENOV, like Victor, US Academy, .org. And the best way to get to me is email. The letter K, Edwards, EDWARDS, at novusacademy.org.
Thank you.
And I answer emails. Don't leave me a voice message. You'll never hear from me.
She does answer emails. That's a true story.
I do answer emails.
Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you.